dismissed, we're going to turn our attention now to Yahweh, to his testimony, and therefore to his covenant and his means to instill its benefits. We have been for a number of shows refuting what is the principal Christian claim that the Torah cannot save, that the Torah cannot be observed, that the Torah should be ignored. Christians, of course, are incapable of recognizing that Yahusha was Torah observant. They don't know what observe means. They think observe means to keep, as opposed to consider, to evaluate, to examine. They don't know what the Torah means teaching. They think it means laws. They think that God has asked us to obey something when there isn't even a Hebrew word for obey. And they come to this conclusion because of Paul's animosity to the Torah. Paul is the prophet of Christianity. He's the founder of the Christian religion. Christianity has almost nothing in common with Yahusha, the Messiah, and has everything in common with Paul's letters. And so we have been examining this so that our understanding of the value of the Torah is equivalent to Yahweh's, because since Yahusha's presentation and determination, consideration of the Torah is identical and was identical to Yahweh's, then. And since he said that all that matters is Yahweh's position relative to his Torah teaching, under those considerations, since Yahweh created the universe, conceived life, and is the only source of salvation, methinks it would be a really good idea to assure that our perspective on the Torah mirrors God's perspective. I really don't care what Paul's perspective on the Torah is. I don't care what the Christian perspective on the Torah is, other than that if it differs from Yahweh's perspective, then I wish to expose it and condemn the Christian and Pauline perspective to help others distance themselves from those errant perspectives. All that should matter is what is God's position on his Torah. Now, speaking of the wolf in sheep's clothing, deceiving people and luring them away from the value of the Torah, speaking to those who would be deceived by this wolf in sheep's clothing, Yahusha, in his Sermon on the Mount, the most important declaration he ever made, said, "All of those calling me Lord, Lord, will not enter the kingdom of heaven. But to the contrary, those in heaven are those who do my Father's will. They do what he proposed," which means they observe the directions that he has provided to us in his Torah. "Many will say to me on this specific day, Lord, Lord, did we not speak inspired utterances and prophecies in your name and drive out demons in your name and perform many mighty miracles in your name? And then at that time I will profess to them that I never knew them. You must depart from me, those who bring about that which is in opposition to the Torah." And so here we have Christian apologists in opposition to the Torah, saying that the Torah cannot save, that the Torah has nothing to do with us, that the Torah cannot be kept. And God is saying that if you hold that position, I don't know you. Get away from me. Be gone. Now that would include every Christian on the planet. All of them. That would include, of course, every Muslim on the planet. That would include every socialist, secular humanist on the planet. But also here is this statement that is so germane to our understanding. You know, we had a call a couple of days ago from a fellow that asked a wonderful question, and we spent our entire program a day or so ago answering his question on why Yahweh had to manifest himself as the Messiah Yahusha to enable the promises that he had made in his Torah? That was a question that this individual had asked us. But prior to asking that question, some might have been critical of me for being very harsh on this individual regarding his profession of a religious conversion experience based on the name Jesus. And the reason I was so harsh on him is in large part to this particular statement. God is saying, you know, you may think that you had a religious experience. You may think that in some other name that you came to know me. You may think that you even performed miracles. You may even think that you received prophetic insights. But I'm telling you, it's not the case. It isn't true. You really don't know me. And you're not saved by me because I'm sending you away. So when other people call this program, as many have written me, saying I had a profound, you know, conversion experience, and it was in the name of Jesus, and the Lord did this, and I had that, and I changed this, I'm going to say, no, bull. It's not true. You aren't saved. You don't know God. Now, that's remediable in the case of this individual that called. He is making that transition from being deceived by religion to coming to know the truth. That's why I'm so pleased that he not only listens to the program, but asks questions. And we will continue just as Yahusha was. He was blunt. He was bold. He was not tolerant here. He was not trying to be lovey-dovey here. He told the people who were listening, no, I don't know you. Get away from me. We need to be that blunt, that bold, particularly when addressing deception, just as he did. He was addressing the wolf sheep's clothing that would have people be in opposition to the Torah. There's only one person in human history that fits that statement like a glove. Paul. His letters exist to oppose the Torah. He is the wolf in sheep's clothing who has led so many astray so that God does not know them. The question is, are you listening? I mean, this is a scathing indictment, not only of Paul's epistles, but the preponderance of the Christian New Testament, but also almost all of Christian teaching. God just told us that Yahusha's name matters, as does Yahweh's Torah. Further, the presence of miracles does not equate to the presence of God, as Christian apologists claim. Listen to that again. You know, Paul tried to justify his apostleship by talking about all the miracles that he performed. And so Christians are wont to believe that he was inspired and empowered by God because he performed miracles. God's saying that ain't the case. You can think that you performed countless miracles, large and small. But if you don't really know who I am, if you don't know the will of my Father, Yahweh, as he brought it to us, if you're in opposition to the Torah, his teaching, his direction, it's not me who inspired those miracles, who made them possible. Now, there's only one other spirit in operation in our world. He didn't say it, but he didn't have to. Who is it then that inspired Paul when he performed miracles? Who empowered him? Since it wasn't Yahweh. HaSatan. Paul admits to it. 2 Corinthians, the letter to Corinth, the second letter. He says that that thorn that is in his side is one of Satan's messengers. He was demon-possessed. Yahusha could not have made this message any clearer in his first and only public declaration before a large audience. He told us what we could rely upon and what we could trust. The Torah. Yahweh. He even said that a self-serving insider, someone pretending to be one of his sheep, would feign an alliance with him so that he could more easily snatch souls away from God. One would have to be naive not to see Paul and his letters in Yahusha's statement. And that means that the person Christians quote most often to justify their religion and their animosity to the Torah was a false prophet. Someone not to be trusted. Those familiar with this 721 passage that is found in Matanyah, at least as it is presented in their English Bibles, probably noticed that I indeed moved the negation from not all of those to will not enter. You should you object to or just question this action, even though I told you in advance that I was doing it and why I was doing it, be aware of the following. The teaching on the Mount is unequivocal, and it is uncompromising throughout. It is black and white. Unequivocal, uncompromising, in every aspect. And in this context, placing the negation within the phrase, will not enter the kingdom of heaven, is vastly more consistent with the tone and content of this speech. Particularly as it concludes by banishing those, by God saying, I do not know, and I want no part of you. Go away, all of those who are in opposition to my Torah. Before we move on, let's see if we can learn something additional about Yahweh's most important title by observing in the language of Revelation. God is speaking here in terms of how we come to know him, how we come to approach him, of his Bereth covenant. In this, the first letter of Bereth, which is the Hebrew word for covenant, family-oriented relationship, it is a contracted form of Beth, the first letter is, and Beth is the Hebrew word for family and home. So immediately, just by looking at the letters which comprise the title, we know what God is talking about. I am Yada. This is Shattering Myths. To Shattering Myths. We were in the process of considering the letters that comprise what could arguably be the most important word. It's a title in the whole of Yahweh's Torah teaching. Now, the most important name, of course, is Yahweh. But there is and while Yahweh as a name is vastly more important than is anything else, when you just turn to the words themselves, there is no more important word than covenant. And covenant is based on the Hebrew word bereth. Now, when I say covenant, many people might think of, okay, that's a religious thing. No, it's not. They might think that's a Jewish thing. And no, it's not really a Jewish thing either. What they don't realize is that covenant is the word bereth in Hebrew is based upon the Hebrew word beeth, which comprises the first letter of bereth. So bereth begins with beeth, which is the second letter of the Hebrew alphabet, and a letter which is comprised of the Hebrew word beeth, which means home and family. And so when God speaks of covenant, this is not a religious institution. This is not a complicated concept of all. It is simply family. God established his family, his bereth, his family. And the only difference between bereth and the beeth, this family and the covenant, is that Bereth speaks of a family relationship where Be'eth is strictly family and home. So there are specific terms and conditions of this to participate in this particular family. Anyway, the first letter, Bereth, is Be'eth is was drawn originally in the form of a home. It's a floor plan of a home with a door and a sheltered area. And it's the whole concept of the letter, the second letter in the Hebrew alphabet, was to shelter and protect a family. The second letter of Bereth is the Hebrew Rosh. It was originally pronounced Resh, which was depicted by drawing the head of a person, and as it does so, the word Resh today in ancient Hebrew is symbolic of the first, the best, and the foremost of things, as well as with leadership and birth. So God is giving birth to his family. God is leading his family. And this particular family that is part of the Bereth is the first, best, and foremost family, because it is God's family. Now, turning to the third letter, we find a Yod, which has become known as a Yod. The Yod is the first letter of Yahweh's name. The Yod, now known as a Yod, is depicted by way of an arm and a hand. It's the upper arm reaching down, the forearm reaching out, and an open hand. It conveyed the ideas of not only authority and power, but more directly of someone engaging productively to accomplish something. So in the case of Yahweh's name, it is God engaging productively to accomplish his heart's desire, which is to lift us up and into his home. So the final letter then in Bereth is either a Teth or a Taw, as these letters were originally the same in ancient Hebrew. If Teth, the pictograph, was of a woven container, which was used to communicate the idea of being surrounded, being enclosed, and of being transported from one place to another, and if it's a Taw, the character was drawn as an upright pole with a horizontal support beam. It spoke of a doorway, of a foundation that provides support. It was also the Hebrew symbol for sign and signature, particularly in its Paleo-Hebrew form. Now, bringing all of these images together, the picture they paint of the Bereth, the covenant, is of the first and foremost family being protected and sheltered in a home by way of the work, the power, the authority, the actual engagement and activity of God, so that his household might rely on the words which he affixed his signature, and thereby be transported to heaven through the doorway known as Passover. That is what covenant means, as it was scribed in the language in which Yahweh himself etched the concept in stone. I'm Yada. This is Shattering Myths. In the next segment, we are going to turn to the Torah itself to determine Yahweh's perspective on his Torah so that our understanding equates to his. Usually. The Shattering Myths program. We are in the midst of now considering Yahweh's testimony regarding his Torah, so that the hope of this review is so that we might understand what God's position is regarding his teaching, his Torah guidance, and so that ultimately those who are interested in aligning their understanding of God's teaching, his instructions, with that of the authors, will have the opportunity to do so. So Yahweh here is speaking to Yitzhak. Yitzhak is the name of Abraham's son by way of his wife. Yitzhak would be the heir to the covenant that was formed with and confirmed with his father Abraham. While Abraham's name means a merciful and enriching father, see, the covenant enriches us, and it is the means to Yahweh's mercy. And Yahweh uses Abraham as a symbol for himself in the covenant. That's why it is the merciful and enriching father. Esau's name in Hebrew means laughter. He is named laughter because that's the product of the covenant. The purpose of the covenant is laughter. I mean, it really doesn't get any more complicated than that. God created his family-oriented covenant relationship because he likes to have a good time, because he wants to have fun, because he wants to enjoy the laughter associated with his children. That's really it. It's not any more complicated than that. Yitzhak was named laughter because that's the purpose of the covenant. So he says, and this I am now going to observe Yahweh's testimony by reciting it in Bereshit, which is the first book of the Torah. It means in the beginning. It's been corrupted by the Greek to Genesis. This is the 26th chapter, the 3rd verse. Dwell as a guest in this land, and I will choose to exist with you. Indeed, I will kneel down in love and bless you. To you and to your offspring, accordingly, I will give all of God's realm. And I will take a stand. I will establish and confirm with you the oath of friendship, which relationally I promised to Abraham, your father. Now, before we go on to the next statement here, it's actually the same statement, just a continuation of it. Let's just examine a few of these Hebrew words and make certain that we get the full benefit of what God just said. He said, dwell as a guest, ger. This is interesting that he would say, dwell as a guest in this land. This land is a realm and region. Because he's now speaking of what would become Yisrael, the promised land. But, you know, in the promised land of Yisrael, we are simply guests. Even as members of God's family, as the covenant, we are simply guests in God's land. We don't become part of a permanent resident until we understand that the Eretz, the land, the promised land, represents, and it's the Eretz Amar, which means the land that is of the word, the land that was promised by Yahweh. Amar is the Hebrew word for to speak, to communicate. So that the land, the realm that God is speaking about, we don't become full-time residents as heirs, as opposed to guests, until we are in Yahweh's home, which the land, the promised land, is symbolic of. So it's dwell as a guest in this land, which and I will choose to exist. Haya, I will actually be. Now, this, first of all, Haya is the most important verb in the entire Hebrew lexicon. I say that unequivocally, unabashedly, that Haya is the single most important verb in the entirety of the Hebrew lexicon. And the reason for that is Haya is the basis of Yahweh's name. You want to know how to pronounce Yahweh's name? Look at Haya. Haya is an interesting word. It reads the same left to right as it does right to left. Haya includes Yah in it, which is the first syllable of Yahweh's name. It tells us you how to pronounce Yahweh's name. Haya. Now, beyond that, Haya speaks of existence. It means in first person, it would mean I was, I am, and I will be. Now, if we wish to exist, we need to associate ourselves with the source of our existence, Yahweh. Beyond this, in Hebrew, there is no past, present, or future tense. All verbs in Hebrew simply are. They are always true. And so God is saying, dwell as a guest in this land, and I will choose to always exist with you. Haya. Now, this was scribed in the call relational stem. The call relational stem denotes reality. It is not hypothetical. I will actually, God is saying, choose to always exist with you. And a relationship, because the call stem is a relational stem. It was written in the imperfect conjugation. There are two conjugations in Hebrew, the imperfect and the perfect. The perfect speaks of a completed action, but not necessarily in the past. And the imperfect speaks of an ongoing action with ongoing continuing consequences. So God choosing to exist with us is something that is ongoing, that continues over time. Now, this was also scribed in the cohortative voice. Now, I understand some of you have got to be listening and saying, you know, what is it with this guy and this grammar stuff? You know, I just want to know what God said. Don't confuse me with all this grammar stuff. There's a reason that we go into this. Hebrew is an extraordinarily unique language. It is the only language whereby God can manifest himself in his own testimony. Only in Hebrew. Because only in Hebrew are verbs always true. They're not stuck in time like English verbs are. But also, virtually every verb in Hebrew is scribed in a stem, and the stems all denote relationships between the object and the subject and the action of the verb, as does this one in the call stem, which denotes that this is a real relationship that's existing between Yishak and Yahweh, and all of the heirs of Yishak, which would be the sons and daughters of the covenant thereafter. But also, in the imperfect and perfect, we don't have a concept like that in English where we can speak of either a concluded action with a finite start and ending date or an ongoing action that has unfolding consequences. This was written in the imperfect. That tells you about this, something about this relationship. God is going to exist with us. We are going to exist with God forever as a result of the covenant. That's what the imperfect says. And that there are unfolding consequences as a result of that ongoing relationship. Now, third, this is where we're getting to the cohortative mood here. It's voice. It does something that exists uniquely in Hebrew, where virtually all verbs have the option of being scribed in a mood. And most every mood is volitional, especially the cohortative. It expresses God's strong desire to exist with us. You know, remember the statement I just read about Yahusha? And he says, you know, come to know and do and embrace the Father's will, his desire. Well, the cohortative mood expresses a first-person desire. So it says that when we choose to dwell as a guest in this land, God chooses to exist with us. That's what God's will is. He wants to live with us. So that's what is being conveyed here. And when you simply say that dwell as a guest in the land and I will exist with you, you miss all of that. You miss the relationship and the reality and the genuineness of this relationship conveyed by the call, or the ongoing nature and the unfolding consequences of this conveyed by the imperfect conjugation, and the choice, the desire, the will of God that is expressed by the voice of the cohortative. Now, the next part that follows is also really instructive. And, you know, I'm taking up a lot of time here, and we were trying to get to what God's position was on his Torah, and we will get to that because he speaks of it. But understanding everything he had to say is essential, because look how much we learned just by amplifying these words, by examining them, by observing them closely. We are doing now what God asked us to do with his Torah, and this is a statement that is found in his Torah, which is to observe it carefully, closely, examining it, because the more closely we examine it, the more we come to understand. This next statement is part of that. God says, I will barak, and it's typically just written as I will bless you. And barak can mean bless and does have a connotation of bless. It also means to favor. But that's not the primary meaning of barak. The primary meaning of barak is to kneel down. It is to diminish oneself. And so God is saying that I will exist with you by kneeling down in love, diminishing myself, an aspect of myself, to greet you and to favor you. Barak also speaks of greeting. Now, you might say, wait a minute, isn't man supposed to bow down before God, not God bowing down before man? No, it's exactly the opposite. And that's the beauty of understanding that the covenant is a family relationship and that God is, as Yahusha said, he is our father in that covenant. So when you understand that this family exists with God serving as the father, it is appropriate for a father to get on his knees, to relate to his children, to lift them up, to help them grow. And that's the role God wants to play. Moreover, we were talking a couple of programs ago of why Yahweh had to manifest himself as Yahusha to enable his Torah promises. Yahusha is God on his knees. Yahusha is God diminishing himself in love so that he can lift us up. That's what it represents. So he's saying here that to be with us, he is going to kneel down in love to bless us. He says, to you and to your offspring. What is the offspring of Abraham and Yitzhak? What's the offspring of the covenant? It's all of God's children. The children who choose to engage in this family relationship by observing its terms and conditions and embracing them. And so God is going to act like a father, kneeling down to lift up his children, all of us who are the offspring of the covenant. We will return to the final segment of Shattering Myths in just a moment.
My name is...
Welcome back to the final segment of Shattering Myths for today. I hope you'll join us tomorrow. We're going to continue this discussion, this opportunity to observe Yahweh's Torah by reciting his testimony. He went on to say in this opening statement to Yitzhak, who was the heir to the one and only covenant, the covenant established with Abraham, he says, to you and to your offspring accordingly, I will give. This is Natan. Natan means I will grant as a gift, I will bestow, and I will entrust all of God's realm, the Eretz land. And I will take a stand to establish and to confirm. This now is from Qum. Qum is one of the Hebrew words that most people know because we grew up singing a campfire song, Kumbaya. Qum means to stand. Ba in Hebrew is the Hebrew word for in or by. And Yah is Yahweh's name. So, Kumbaya means stand by Yah, stand with Yah, stand in Yah. And so it says, and I will take a stand, I will establish and I will confirm. All derivatives of Kum means I will stand upright, I will arise, I will affirm, I will fill, I will accomplish, I will validate. This now was scribed with the Hiphel stem. The Hiphel stem is also a voice of relationships, forever associating Yah with taking this stand. And the perfect, so that means that Yah personally is involved in taking this stand. That's what the Hiphel stem means here, which means that who was the one that took the stand for us, who stood up for us so that we could stand with him? Yahusha. By using the Hiphel here with Qum, what Yahweh is telling us is that he is Yahusha. So that when Yahusha stood up for us by fulfilling the Torah's promises, that Yahusha was Yahweh on his knees. And so it also was written in the perfect conjugation. In this case, what God is saying, that when he takes a stand on our behalf, when he stands up for us on Passover, unleavened bread, and first fruits, so that we can stand with him, that his work is complete, that nothing else needs to be done, that he will do everything that is required to accomplish his purpose. God is telling us that his commitment will endure through the entirety of time, totally complete, and in also in the consecutive form. In the consecutive form, it also conveys volition, telling us that this is all of God's choosing, and he wants it to be our choice as well, for us to choose to kumbaya. And now he continues this. He says, "And I will take a stand, establish and confirm with the oath of friendship, Shabua." Shabua is a really an interesting term. The fourth of the seven invitations where God has called us out of this world so that we can meet with him is named Shabua. Shabua speaks of the promise of seven. There are seven steps to our salvation. They exist as God's promise to us, and they are all an oath of friendship, which is what Shabua conveys. So it's a pledge and promise relating to the Shabbat and to the affirmation of the truth conveyed by seven. God's formula for our reconciliation is six, which is the number of man who is conceived on the sixth day, plus God who is one, equating to absolute perfection from God's point of view, to his promise to be with us. That's all conveyed by this oath of friendship of Shabua, which relationally, Asher, by way of making a connection, building association, and fortuitously, I promised Shaba. I swore and affirmed a binding oath based upon seven and the meaning behind the Sabbath, Shabbat, to Abraham, which is a compound of Ab, meaning father, and Raham, love and mercy, and Hamon, meaning enriching, conveying collectively, loving, merciful, and enriching Father. The covenant enriches us. Your Father, Ab. Ab, of course, is comprised of the first two letters of the Hebrew alphabet, the Aleph and the Beth, which collectively speak of the ability and leadership and power of God to establish his family. And God then continues, "And I will grow and thrive," which we'll get to in a moment. "And I will," this is God speaking, God saying, "I will grow and I will thrive with your offspring in connection with the highest and most illuminated spiritual realm. And I will give to your offspring everything associated with this realm of God. And also all people from every race and place will be blessed with this favorable circumstance through your offspring." Oh, there's so much to consider, and we'll get to it again at this time tomorrow. May Yah bless.
Hi, I'm Dr. Joel Wallach, the Dead Doctors Don't Lie guy. There's no reason why you shouldn't live to be at least 100 and have a great time getting there. And I'm going to give you a free copy of